"General, one of the patrols has been calling you urgently on the radio," the pilot spoke in China's earphones. "They are using the call sign 12 Red."
"Very well. Please switch to the patrol frequency," China ordered,
and watched the digital display on the panel of his radio transmitter.
12 Red, this is Banana Tree. Do you read?"
He spoke into his helmet microphone. 12 Red was one of the crack scouting groups sweeping for Spur south of the railway line. Glancing at the map on his knee, China tried to guess the scout's exact position. The section leader answered his call almost immediately.
"Banana Tree, this is 12 Red. We have a confirmed contact."
China felt the excitement and triumph rise in his chest, but he kept his voice level.
"Report your position," he ordered.
And as the section leader read out the coordinates, China checked them on his field map and saw that the patrol was about 35 miles due north of the village.
"Have you got that, pilot?" he asked. "Get there as fast as you can."
And as the engine tone of the Hind rose sharply, he called ahead.
12 Red, give us a red flare when you have us in sight."
7 minutes later, the flare arced up out of the forest almost directly under the Hind's nose, and the pilot slowed the machine and let it drift down towards the treetops. The Renamo patrol had cleared a landing zone with their machetes, and the pilot manoeuvred the Hind into it and let her settle in a cloud of dust and debris. He saw with satisfaction that the scouts had thrown out a protective screen around the landing zone. They were crack bush fighters. China leapt eagerly out of the cockpit, and the section leader came forward to salute him. He was a lean veteran, festooned with weapons and water bottles and bandoliers of ammunition.
"They passed this way sometime yesterday," he reported. "Are you sure it's them?"
China demanded.
"The white man and woman," the section leader nodded. "But they buried something over there."
He pointed with his chin.
"We have not touched it, but I think it is a grave." "Show me,"
China ordered, and followed him into the thorn thicket. The section leader stopped beside a cairn of boulders.
"Yes, a grave," China said with finality. "Open it up."
The section leader snapped an order at two of his men, and they laid aside their weapons and went forward. They kicked away the top stones and rolled them down the slope.
"Hurry," China called. "Work faster."
And the ironstone boulders rang against each other and struck sparks as they were hurled aside.
"There is the corpse,"
the section leader called, as Job's bundled head was exposed. He stepped forward and jerked aside the stained shirt that covered it.
"It's the Matabili."
China recognized Job's features immediately.
"I didn't think he'd get this far. Dig him out and feed him to the hyena," he ordered.
Two of the scouts reached down and seized Job's blanket-wrapped shoulders, and China watched with ghoulish interest. Mutilation of the enemy dead was an ancient Nguni custom. The ritual disembowelment allowed the spirit of the vanquished to escape so that it would not plague the victor. There was, however, a vindictive satisfaction in watching his men exhume the Matabili. He understood what grief this act would cause Sean Courtney, and he relished how he would describe it to him in his next radio transmission. At that moment he spotted the short length of bark twine. It was twisted lightly around the blanket-wrapped shoulders of the corpse. For a moment he stared at it with puzzlement, and then as he saw it tighten and heard the click of the grenade primer, he realized what it was, and he screamed a warning and hurled himself face forward to the earth. The explosion crushed his eardrums and filled his head with pain. He felt the blast wave hit him, and something struck him in the cheek with numbing force. He rolled into a sitting position, and for a moment thought that he had lost his eyesight. Then the stars and Catherine wheels of light that filled his head dissipated, and with a rush of relief he realized that he could see again. Blood was streaming down the side of his face and dribbling from his chin onto the front of his battle-dress blouse. He whipped the handkerchief from around his neck and wadded it into the deep gash that a fragment from the grenade had opened across the cheekbone. Unsteadily, he came to his feet and stared down into the grave. The grenade had gutted one of his men like a fish. He was kneeling and trying to push his own bowels back into the hole, but the wet lining was sticking to his bare hands. The second gorilla had been killed cleanly. The section leader sprang to China's side and tried to examine the gash in his cheek, but China struck his hands away.
"You white bastard," his voice was shrill. "You will pay dearly for that, Colonel Courtney. I swear to you."
The wounded gorilla was still fumbling with his own entrails, but they bulged out between his fingers. He was making a dreadful, cawing, bubbling sound that only increased General China's fury.
"Get that man out of here," he screamed. "Take him away and shut him up."
They dragged the wounded man away, and still China was not satisfied. He was shaking wildly with shock and fury, looking around for something on which to vent his rage.
"You men,"
he pointed with a trembling finger,
"bring your pangas."
Two guerrillas ran forward to obey.
"Pull that Matabili dog out of his hole. That's right. Now, use the pangas. Chop him up into hyena food. That's it. Small pieces. Don't stop. Mincemeat. I want him turned into mincemeat."
All that morning, Matatu led them southwards through the abandoned fields and past the deserted villages. The weeds and rank secondary growth gave them good cover, and they avoided the footpaths and skirted the burnt-out huts. Claudia was having difficulty keeping up. They'd been going with only brief rests since the previous evening, and she was reaching the limits of her endurance. There was no sensation of pain. Even the devilish little red-tipped thorns that left red, weeping lines across the exposed skin of her arms merely tugged painlessly at her as she passed. Her steps were leaden and mechanical, and though she tried to keep the rhythm of the march, she felt herself running down like a clockwork toy. Slowly, Sean drew ahead of her, and she couldn't lengthen her stride to hold him. He glanced over his shoulder and saw how she was lagging and slowed for her to catch up. "I'm sorry," she blurted, and he glanced at the sky. "We have to keep going," he answered, and she toiled on behind him. A little after midday, they heard the hind again. The sound of its engines were very faint and grew fainter still, dwindling away into the north. Sean put out an arm to steady Claudia as she swayed on her feet. "Well done," he told her gently. "I'm sorry I had to do that to you, but we've made good ground. China will never expect us to have got so far south. He has headed back northwards, and we can rest now." He led her to a cluster of low thorn acacia, which formed a natural shelter. She sobbed with exhaustion as she sank to the hard ground, and lay quietly as Sean squatted in front of her to remove her shoes and socks. "Your feet have hardened up beautifully," he told her as he massaged them gently. "Not a sign of a blister. You're as tough as a scout and twice as gutsy." She couldn't even raise a smile at the compliment. Sean pulled her sock over his hand, stuck one finger through the hole in the toe, and wiggled it like a ventriloquist's dummy.
"Okay, she walks good," he made the sock speak like Miss Piggy. "But Buster, you should see her in the sack."
Claudia giggled weakly, and he smiled down at her gently. "That's better," he said. "Now go to sleep." For a few minutes longer, she watched him working on her sock. "Which of your trollops taught you to darn?" she murmured drowsily. "I was a virgin until I met you." "Go to sleep." "I hate her, whoever she was," Claudia said, and closed her eyes. It seemed to her that she opened them again immediately, but the light had changed to soft shades of evening, and the midday heat had cooled. She sat up. Sean was cooking over a small fire of dry sticks, and he looked across at her. "Hungry?" he asked.
"Starving."
"Dinner." He brought the metal billy to her.
"What is it?"
she asked suspiciously, and peered down at the heap of scorched black sausages, each the size of her little finger.
"Don't ask," he said. "Eat."
Gingerly, she picked one out and sniffed at it. It was still hot from the cooking fire.
"Eat,"
he repeated, and to set an example, popped one into his own mouth, chewed, and swallowed.
"Damned good," he gave his opinion.
Go ahead. Carefully she bit into it, and it squelched between her teeth and burst, filling her mouth with the consistency of warm custard that tasted like creamed spinach. She forced it down. Have another. No, thanks. They're full of protein. Eat. I couldn't. You won't last out the next march on an empty stomach. Open your mouth. He fed her, and then himself alternately. When the billy was empty, she asked again, Now tell me, what have I been eating? But he grinned and shook his head and turned to Alfonso, who was squatting across the fire, devouring his share of the meal. Rig the radio, Sean ordered. Let's hear if China has anything to say. While Alfonso was busy stringing the radio aerial, Matatu slipped quietly into the camp. He was carrying a cylinder of freshly peeled bark, whose ends were stoppered with plugs of dried grass. He and Sean exchanged a few words, and Sean looked serious. What is it? Claudia asked with concern. Matatu has seen a lot of sign up ahead. It looks like there's a great deal of patrol activity. Frelimo or Renamo, he can't tell which. That made her uneasy, and Claudia moved a little closer to where Sean sat and leaned against his shoulder. Together they listened to the radio, and here again there seemed to be a much higher level of traffic, most of it in Shangani or African-accented Portuguese. There is something brewing, Alfonso grunted, as he concentrated on the set. They are moving patrols into a stop line. Renamo? Sean asked, and Alfonso nodded. Sounds like General Depotip's men. What does he say? Claudia asked. But Sean didn't want to alarm her further. Routine traffic, he lied, and Claudia relaxed and watched Matatu at the cooking fire as he carefully unstoppered the bark cylinder and shook out its contents onto the coals. As she realized what he was cooking, she stiffened with horror. Those are the most disgusting. She couldn't finish, and she stared in awful fascination at the huge hairy caterpillars writhing and wriggling on the coals. Their long ginger hair frizzled off in little puffs of smoke, and gradually the worms stopped moving and curled into little crisp black sausages. Claudia let out a tiny strangled cry and clutched at Sean's arm as she recognized them. They aren't, she gasped. I didn't. You didn't make me. Oh, no, I can't believe. Highly nutritious, Sean assured her. And Matatu, seeing the direction of her gaze, picked one of the caterpillars out of the coals and, passing it quickly from hand to hand to cool it, offered it to her with a magnanimous flourish. I think I'm going to throw up, Claudia said faintly and turned her face away. I can't believe I actually ate one of those. At that moment, the radio crackled sharply, and a voice spoke very faintly in a guttural language that Claudia couldn't understand. However, Sean's sudden interest in the transmission distracted her from her feelings of nauseous disgust, and she asked, What language is that? Afrikaans, he replied shortly. Quiet, listen. But the transmission faded out abruptly.
Afrikaans? She asked. South African Dutch?
That's right, Sean nodded. We must be getting within extreme range. That was almost certainly a South African military transmission, probably a border patrol on the Limpopo. Sean spoke briefly to Alfonso and then told Claudia. He agrees. South African border patrol. Alfonso says it sometimes picks up skip transmissions like that even further north. Sean checked his wristwatch. Well, it doesn't look as though General China is going to entertain us this evening. We'd better pack up and get ready to march. Sean had half risen when suddenly the radio burst into life again. This time the voice was so clear that they could hear every intake of General China's breath.
Good evening, Colonel Courtney. Please forgive me for the late schedule, but I have had urgent business to attend to. Come in, please, Colonel Courtney.
In the silence that followed, Sean made no move towards the microphone, and General China chuckled softly across the ether.